Between 1969 and 2009, the percentage of doctorates awarded to women in the life sciences increased from 15% to 52%.
But a recent survey of over 2,000 biology labs in the U.S. found that less than 30% of assistant professors and roughly 20% of full professors in biology-related fields are women.
Today we'll be talking about the attrition of women from academic careers.
The leaky pipeline problem.
We discuss the factors that contribute to this problem and what institutions can do to help mitigate it. All of this and more on a very special episode of Neurotransmissions.
Welcome to Neurotransmissions, neuroscience stories from the lab and life, by scientists, for everyone. Your hosts today are Drs. Misha Smirnov, Joe Schumacher, and Ben Scholl.
Hi, everyone. This is Misha, and I'm here with Joe.
Hey, Misha.
So, Joe, what's going on in life sciences? If more than 50% of both bachelor's and doctoral degrees go to women in biological sciences, what's happening at later career points from postdocs to faculty positions that contributes to this leaky pipeline problem?
It's a common refrain to hear that we need more women in science, but honestly, women are doing science. The problem is the fact that women are statistically more likely to drop out. Let's think about it. If there are factors other than scientific achievement that are contributing to this, it undermines the meritocracy of science, and it represents an underuse of the skills of highly trained doctoral graduates.
Right. So essentially, we may be structuring the life sciences in a way that inhibits our own ability to put our best and our brightest on the problems that they could be working on.
Exactly.
Now, the life sciences, which include neuroscience and biology, are special because this happens at such a late career stage.
That's right. In fields like physics, math, and computer science, there's also a problem of underrepresentation for women, but this doesn't happen so late. It happens almost at the outset, where less than 20% of undergraduate majors are women in the first place. Now, we have a bunch of data that we're going to discuss throughout this episode. But we also got in touch with someone who's a little more qualified to talk about this than we are.
I've been at Rockefeller for 15 years, and our experience is the same as every other institution. So only about 25% of the applicant pool is female. And you contrast that to graduate student populations are 50% female. Even at our postdoctoral level at Rockefeller, 50% of our postdocs are female. So you have to wonder, okay, what's happening to 50% of our female scientist population? Where are they going?
Right. What is it about this step that is sort of like a filter? Yeah. That was Leslie Vosshall. She's the Robin Chemers Neustein Professor at the Rockefeller University, where she is the head of the Laboratory of Neurogenetics and Behavior. She's also an investigator of the Howard Hughes Medical Institute.
When dissecting the reason behind the loss of female scientists at later career stages, Leslie brings up some strong points.
I don't have all the answers, but I think it's been discussed widely. So I think some of it is external. So we the whole infrastructure of science and society, it makes it harder for women to proceed. And I think some of it is internal to the candidate, where the expectations for themselves are lowered relative to the expectations that their male peers have. Their self-confidence is lowered. They feel less sure that there's a path forward in academic science. They're more reluctant to keep going. And I just feel confident that if we just address that head on by dealing with the implicit bias that makes it harder for women to get a foothold, and also just raising the expectations. I don't want to blame the postdoc and say that, okay, you don't have any self-confidence, but I just want to help turn the conversation around and say, we have expectations. We think you can do this.
So here she's already identified two factors that contribute to this problem: different expectations and self-confidence for women job candidates, and also systemic implicit bias against women applying to faculty positions.
She also goes on to address a topic which is commonly assumed to play a major role. How about having babies?
When you're nearing the end of your postdoc and you're starting to decide what the next steps are, it aligns perfectly with both men and women starting to think about starting families. Not everybody has children, and not everybody who has a child has a spouse, right? So there's it's there's a diversity of situations sure. that people face. Absolutely. So I think it ends up being a question where female postdocs start to worry, how am I going to pull all of this off? How am I going to get my great paper? How am I going to put my job application together? How am I going to relocate across the country if I'm married and I'm pregnant, I'm on the job market? How am I going to be viewed? So it is extremely complex.
So why is the decision to raise a family an anti-career choice for female but not male scientists?
Well, there's some data behind that. First, surveys of graduate and postdoctoral researchers show that women rank work-life balance and parenthood-related issues as having higher importance than men. Second, the perceived difficulty of raising a family in a tenure-track position is higher for women than men. Male postdocs are twice as likely to expect their spouse to make career sacrifices for family than women postdocs. That said, these are simply observations made from surveys. They don't comment on whether this is right or wrong. Rather, they just highlight a certain reality. Here's Leslie's take.
I think it's wrong on both ends. Assume that it's only a problem for female scientists. So I think institutions should work-life balance, parental leave, these things, it really should be aimed both at male recruits and female recruits. This should not only be, children are not the only responsibility of the mother.
So absolutely.
I had a baby, I was pregnant my first year as a faculty member, I had my baby in the second year. And so it really, it's a problem with everybody in society to deal with, you know, to help people produce the next generation of humans. We need humans.
Sure.
Like my baby and everybody else's baby is going to, they're going to be filling the jobs, the PhD programs, making coffee, right? So we generally should be supportive of people having children. And so I think on all levels, we need to help women not drop out of the pipeline for that reason. It's only medically a problem for, you know, you're pregnant for 9 months, and so there should be some way to accommodate that biological reality. But then the institutions need to pick up the slack. So institutions need to step forward and help people with childcare, with parental leave, and that is actually quite simple. So I think more and more institutions recognize that if they want to recruit and retain the best of the best, they need to have something in place to make that happen. People do have children, and it's an institutional responsibility to help them. Once you get to the other side, once you have a faculty position, I think it's one of the best possible careers that one could have. We have freedom to decide what we do with our time, what kinds of questions we want to investigate. We get to populate our lab with people that we choose. Like, it's a really incredible, flexible career, especially if you want to have children. We don't really have bosses. We can arrange our schedule. We can work from home, right? There could be no better profession on earth. And so you have to commit to doing it and not let these expectations, the things that undermine the ability of women to proceed in the career. There are a lot of negative messages out there. There's a lot of explicit bias. There's a lot of implicit bias that gets in the way. So I think just keeping the eyes on the prize, right? Very cliche things. Keep your eye on that as a goal. And try to get as much help as you can. Apply to institutions. Make it a priority when you apply that you value this. Try to work with both peers who are going through it and also mentors who can encourage you to keep going. I think some of this is people faltering. Because it does seem so hard and it seems so overwhelming.
So there's a biological reality that women face when having children, but these realities are not forever and are not career-ending. Institutions need to help on their part with programs such as parental leave and childcare.
And in addition to these factors, we should assess the persistence of outright discrimination against women in science. One study showed that women with children are less likely to be hired for tenure-track positions than women without children. So institutions need to be sure to have hiring practices in place that acknowledge this implicit bias. Here's Leslie's advice for how to run an effective search for highly qualified female candidates.
Scour the lists of all the most competitive fellowships, the K99, the Jane Coffin Childs, the Helen Hay Whitney.
Mm-hmm.
Make sure that the women on those lists, that we're tracking them and encourage them to apply, right? Because we want to, if they're not applying, we can't interview them. And then have a conversation with the faculty search committee and just make them aware that implicit bias against women, against underrepresented minorities, it's built into human behavior. None of us can escape implicit bias. But at the point that we're talking about it and saying this exists, let's confront it and acknowledge it, so that when people are going through applications, they keep this in mind, that letters of recommendation, or every single letter of recommendation, is implicitly biased against women and minorities, which is true. There's lots of data about
mm-hmm.
that.
Yeah.
The way that research proposals are written by male and female candidates just inherently are different, right? There's something, we're socialized to be different. And so you just have to keep that in mind, look past all of this stuff, and look to the candidate and the science. And then the thing that we've been doing recently at Rockefeller is provide a time in the schedule where all candidates speak to a family advocate, sort of a work-life advocate that is sort of a senior head of human resources, where they go over all the benefits, just tell everybody what the benefits are, childcare, parental leave, the tenure clock, so that nobody has to ask. You don't want to have to be that female candidate who feels uncertain about asking the chair of the search committee, do you have childcare? So that's been really effective. It makes all candidates feel better about the institution, that we take the time to explain that we're valuing you as a candidate, and if you want to have children, if you have children, that we have your back.
Yeah, it sort of takes some of the burden of having to have some of these questions answered off of the candidate, and sort of relieve some of the stress associated with that. That's really smart.
Exactly, we found that to be incredibly effective to convert offers into accepted offers.
To address inequality in representation in academic science, we can't ignore implicit bias in recruitment and in hiring. So a study in 2012 in a prestigious journal sent science faculty resumes for a student lab manager position in which only the name and gender were changed. The applicant with a male name was judged to be more competent, more hireable, and offered higher starting salaries than the female applicants. So such biases are somewhat undeniable. A recent study in the same journal found that specifically renowned male faculty were less likely to employ female postdocs and female graduate students than their less renowned male counterparts. Renowned female faculty did not show this bias.
So these are textbook examples of what Leslie is describing when she talks about implicit bias. And this is something that almost everyone carries with them. It's basically human nature. And if you, the listener, don't believe that you are implicitly biased in certain facets of your social life, we encourage you to check out Project Implicit. This is a program run by researchers out of Harvard University where people can take online association tests to determine to what degree they hold biases towards certain people, whether it be for men and women in science or racial biases. This is something everyone can try for themselves. Leslie and I spoke about Project Implicit and how this research could have huge impacts on hiring outcomes in science.
I've actually interacted with one of the founders of Project Implicit, so Mazarin Banaji.
Mm-hmm.
And I think her work and that of her colleagues is incredibly important. And it isn't as widely known as it should be. And I think if every search committee in the U.S. was informed about implicit bias and was asked to take that test, I think it would radically change the outcomes of hiring. I think we would be hiring many more qualified candidates, recognizing that we have this bias. And in preparation for our call, I just was searching around the web, and I watched this. It's very long. It's 1 hour of the head of Google sort of human potential. They have some department at Google. This 1 hour lecture that he gives to Google employees about implicit bias, it was incredible. It was so effective. But the tech industry has an even more severe problem with identifying, recruiting, and retaining female employees, right? I'm sure you've seen the numbers.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So in biomedical research, we're actually doing pretty well. So I would, if you have a way to point people toward this presentation, I'd recommend it. But I think he goes through some of the Project Implicit training in the talk. And I think it helps because once we realize we're all racist, we're all sexist, we all have this bias, even the most liberal, progressive person. We shouldn't feel guilty or we shouldn't feel bad about it. I think just as long as we recognize it, we should say, in these closed committee meetings where everyone is deciding the fate of a candidate, say, just bring it up. Are we saying these things about the science, or are we saying, is there some part of the conversation here that's actually linked to the gender that's unfair? The record of faculty at senior levels at every institution is appalling. And I would say my own institution has a particularly poor record, so that we're trying to turn around by just addressing it head on. And so we started rolling out some of this implicit bias conversation, making phone calls to urge women to apply, and it's we're already seeing some early success with it. It's actually easy to turn it around.
Now, what she's pointing out here is that it's normal to have biases, but it's important to recognize them and to address them. We do this all the time as scientists anyway. We structure our experiments to control for hidden factors that might corrupt our results.
By holding ourselves accountable for our own implicit biases, we can help to ensure that we and our colleagues are all treated fairly and equitably. Lastly, I asked Professor Vossel to talk a little bit about her experience working as a minority in her field.
In any environment where 80% of your peers are male, I think it's inherent. It's a challenge. I think if you go into an environment where it's 80-20 in either direction, it's uncomfortable for the 20%. I don't have any easy answers. Sheryl Sandberg wrote her whole book Lean In that addressed. Everybody has their own ideas about how to deal with it. Do you become more masculine and try to blend in? That doesn't seem to work. Do you just stand on the sidelines? Everyone will have their own way of dealing with it. My personal way of dealing with it is that I'm just unapologetically myself. I dress the way I want. I raise my hand. I engage in conversations. That will not work for everybody. And it will be demoralizing if people are talking over you, if people are belittling you in public. So it is a huge challenge. And I guess the solution is to find allies, to find people who will back you up in your group of colleagues, to try to commiserate with peers. The few women that are around, try to commiserate with them and plot some sort of way to get through it. If it gets really bad, then go on the job market and go somewhere to an environment that's not as hostile.
Mm-hmm.
But the closer we can get the academic science to 50-50, the closer you get to 50-50, the more the problems go away. I think one thing that's great is that I'm talking with a man. And so I think that for us to fix implicit bias and for us to increase the representation of women and minorities and increase the diversity, it has to be, everybody has to be interested in it. So I think it's really great that you're doing this. I always like talking to women about women in science, but it's so great to talk about men who are interested in women in science. Yeah, because I think the diverse, I'm convinced that a university that has labs headed equally by men and women and that has equal numbers of students and postdocs by gender is just going to be a better place to work. Science will be better. It'll be a more pleasant place to work.
Once again, that was Professor Leslie Vossel talking to us about her experience as a faculty member in the life sciences. You can follow her on Twitter @POLLYP1 And hopefully we'll get her in here again on the podcast to talk about some of her lab's amazing research.
By the way, we here at Neurotransmissions did take the implicit bias test, and we actually sent it out to a few of our colleagues, and of the 20 test takers, 90% showed an implicit bias towards gender roles in science.
Yeah, and this is both men and women who more easily associated men with science and women with the humanities, which to me kind of suggests that it's more of a cultural thing than a gender-based thing.
And so speaking of a cultural basis of bias, actually back in episode 4 of the podcast, we spoke with Dr. Naji. You might remember her as a group leader from Genelia Farm. And she told us a little bit about her experience growing up studying science in China before moving over to the United States. After the interview, we kept talking, and she actually had some interesting things to say about her own experiences as a woman in science, and we'd like to play that for you now.
You mentioned that when you were applying to school in China, your dad said,
right,
you can't be a physicist, you're a woman, physicists are men. Clearly, you sort of ignored that to a large extent, but a lot of people probably get a lot of pressure mm-hmm. to conform to those sort of rules, not just right. in China, but here in the United right. States too. So do you see that as like an ongoing problem in neuroscience specifically, or in science in general? And is there something that could be done to rectify that sort of thing?
I don't think neuroscience is bad in this aspect. Actually, you know, I see more female scientists in neuroscience than in physics, for sure. I think it's really societal, right? And, you know, for women, science and is not an easy career. A scientist is not an easy job. So it really, you know, requires devotion. And I think it's, you know, I think it's just our biology make it a bit more difficult for women, especially if you want to have children, because they do demand your attention, which basically means takes your time away from science. So it is a harder life, you know, for female scientists. And I think at that time, my dad basically, you know, we want our children to live a happy life. And my dad just thinks that, you know, doing science is just maybe, you know, very
if you
demanding.
Were a biologist, you would be unhappy. That's what he thought?
Well, he just felt like, you know, it's harder to be at the very top of the field. And because of the distractions that women often face.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, that's okay. I think I actually feel that being a woman didn't really hurt me at all, because one thing, I think women are better communicators, and we are better at talking to people, and this skill of communicating physics to biologists and the social skill to actually go talk to the biologists, I think being a woman really helped me. I think... actually, I feel that this gender issue, I feel it more strongly after I come to the States. Because in China, when I was growing up, because you know, economy was not strong, we were a poor country at that time, usually, you know, both the parents, you know, both the husband and wife would have to work. So it's much less this gender bias in terms of work than in the States. In the
That's
States, so you know, you are actually, as a woman, when I was growing up, you are expected to work. You expect to get an education so you can work, you know, have a career. In this country, it's a little bit less so, because life is more comfortable. And as a very, for girls who are even from a very young age, you have this kind of this just culture onslaught of like being pretty and being
feminine.
That seems to be a lot more strong here. And I actually worry somewhat for my daughter, because I feel that when I was growing up, you know, I was a nerd, right? But I never feel that I'm the you know, everybody wants to be the nerd.
Right. It wasn't a negative connotation.
No, it's like everybody, they want to talk to me and want to know how I can, you know, learn those subjects. But here, it seems that the girls are facing more pressure to be pretty and sociable, and it's very different.
We were interested in Dr. G's point about gender differences in early education, so we explored it more with our colleague, Ellie Hojabri. Ellie is a postbac here at MPFI and has recently accepted an offer for a PhD program in neuroscience at NYU. So we talked to her about starting out on this career path.
I will say ever since high school, when I was getting into those, you know, AP physics classes and biology and chemistry, I was one of the few girls in a lot of those courses. Even maybe in college, it was a little bit different, but it's definitely not surprising that, that we live in a society where women tend to not at least continue staying in science, and they go to different tracks, more like the liberal arts or.
So you're saying that maybe at like really early stages of education, these biases are already showing themselves. Like women might be less inclined to get into AP physics because
physics, especially. I don't know what it is about that course, but
gender issues aren't always easy to talk about. When searching for possible guests for the episode, we found many, both male and female, who were quite hesitant to get involved. Joe brought this up to Ellie.
Is this something that you and your peers who are like at the same stage, like just entering grad school, talk about? Like, do women at your stage, are they acutely aware of this problem? And is it something that is a topic of conversation?
So yes and no. I think we're all very aware that maybe being a woman in science may help or hurt us in the future. That is a topic we've talked about with at least among my cohorts. But I think the concern about finding jobs due to our sex is later down the line. It's not something that I'm worried about or speaking of just yet. I'm more focused on getting through grad school in one piece, like gracefully and successfully. And I think right now, both males and females are in the same boat. If the main topic of conversation, at least among my friends, is regarding like the concerns of just how we interact as women in front of our PIs, especially male ones, the only gender-related issue I'm thinking about is this. I'm always internally aware of my gender when speaking to male PIs, and I'm constantly gauging, you know, how they respond to me beyond what the actual words that they're using. I'm not sure if you were a man, you'd be that in tune to the mannerisms or of the person you're speaking with, at, like your boss, and or be considering that hidden level of dialogue.
And maybe this is the type of thing people become gradually aware of.
Right.
I'm not sure. But I think also, I mean, maybe you could tell me, is there any reluctance to think about this problem because you don't want to, I don't know, women in science don't want to be known as women in science, right? They want
Correct.
To be known as scientists.
Right.
And if you are concerned with the problem of equality for women in science, then you might be known for talking about problems that people don't want to talk about rather than being known for your work ethic and the quality of your work and stuff.
Well, I think that it should be okay for women to talk about women in science, and it should be okay for men to talk about women in science. I think we're in this transition period where it's starting to become normal that we have both genders in academic positions, and I would say that if I, you know, speaking to some of the more senior researchers that that are female, they had a horrible time trying to get hired, and so we're at this point where we're supposed to be promoting something that didn't used to be normal in the past, and we have to be encouraging having these conversations and just being completely relaxed about talking about it. Yeah, maybe it's not good that you're a woman and you rather talk about your research instead of talking about, you know, being a lady in the field, but it's just like affirmative action. This is something that you do temporarily to even out the field and, you know, just bring awareness to the fact that we're neglecting an entire, you know, race or gender or what have you. I think it's okay to have these conversations, and it should be something that we're proud to speak about and not be avoiding.
And that brings us to the end of this episode. A very special thank you to Leslie Vossall, Naji, Ellie Hojabri, and everyone who helped make this episode happen, including the SciComm department here at MPFI, and a lot of people who helped us off mic. If you're interested in looking into some of the data that we presented in this episode, I'll be posting the articles and data sources that we consulted on our Facebook page, along with some other links that may be useful.
And please follow us on Twitter at NeuroPodcast. And if you like the episode, please share it with your friends and head over to iTunes and rate us. It sounds silly, but a 5-star rating is the way podcasts are promoted over there. I'm at SaladZombie, and Joe is at JW Science. Bye.
Bye.
Oh, yesterday I said that the microscope is a lady because it's complex and needs to be maintained. That was nice.